You're listening to the CyberWire Network, powered by N2K.
And now a word from our sponsor, Netskope. Netskope is a worldwide leader in SASE and Zero Trust. Its unified platform, Netskope One, provides optimized access and Zero Trust security for people, devices, and data anywhere they go, helping customers reduce risk, accelerate performance, and get unrivaled visibility into any cloud, web, and private application activity. To learn more about how Netskope helps customers be ready for anything on their SASE journey, visit netskope.com.
Hi, and welcome to Spycast from the Secret Files of the International Spy Museum in Washington, D.C. I'm Dr. Vince Houghton, the museum's historian and curator. Every week, Spycast brings you interesting conversations with authors, scholars, and practitioners who live in the world of global espionage. If you have any questions, comments, or concerns about Spycast, or if you want to suggest someone who might be a good future guest, email us at spycast@spymuseum.org. That's spycast@spymuseum.org. Also, if you like what you hear, and even if you don't, please take a minute to review us on iTunes or whatever platform you might be listening. We're always looking for ways to make Spycast better, and you can help. So we're joined today by Mark Stout and Chris Moran, two friends of the museum that you've heard here before on Spycast. Mark Stout, who is my immediate predecessor here at the Spy Museum, our third historian, previously worked for 21 years in the national security community, including 13 years as an intelligence analyst for the State Department and then CIA. He's now director of the master's degree program in global security studies and also director of the graduate certificate in intelligence, both at Johns Hopkins University's Krieger School of Arts and Sciences, advanced academic programs here in Washington, D.C. Chris Moran is an associate professor of U.S. national security at the University of Warwick in England. He's the author of several books, including Classified, Secrecy in the State in Modern Britain, and Company Confessions, Secrets, Memoirs, and the CIA. Mark and Chris are both editors and contributors to the new book, Spy Chiefs, a two-volume set that examines the role and impact of heads of intelligence in the United States, United Kingdom, and then even Renaissance Venice to the Soviet Union, Germany, India, Egypt, and Lebanon in the 20th century. So Mark and Chris, welcome, and thank you for joining us here on Spycast.
Happy to be here.
Good to be here.
So it won't be hard to kind of pick up on the differences between the two. It's always difficult when there's multiple guests, but the strong British accent is Mark, of course, and Chris speaks like he's from Alabama. No. So let me start, because this book's a while in the making. Books don't magically, unless your name is James Comey, they don't magically pop up in a couple months. This has been festering for a little while. So what was the inspiration for putting a book together? Because, I mean, what is there, 20-some-odd contributors to this book from all over the world? So what brought all this to fruition?
Sure. So the original intellectual launch pad for the two volumes was a panel put together by Dr. Paul Madrell from Loughborough University in the United Kingdom at the 2014 annual convention of the International Studies Association in Toronto on intelligence leadership. Simultaneously with that panel, similar ideas had been kicking around Warwick University, where I'm based, along with my longtime friend, colleague, and mentor, Professor Richard Aldrich. Specifically, we were looking more at leadership more generally of intelligence organizations, not just spy chiefs, but also presidents and prime ministers. So we all got our heads together. We were delighted to welcome on board Mark Stout, but also Dr. Ioanni Orthanu from Oxford Brookes University, who's a specialist on leadership from an organizational / business management perspective. So we came up with this concept of studying the spy chief, the intelligence leader, and we quickly realized that there is a common narrative or common representation of the spy chief as perpetuated by the media and as perpetuated by Hollywood and popular culture, and that really is that the spy chief is all-knowing and all-powerful. So we thought, for the sake of the historical record, we really should try and test this. So from that original concept, we then proceeded with some questions in mind. How powerful is the spy chief? How secretive have spy chiefs been? How do spy chiefs differ in different national international and institutional and historical contexts? Does the spy chief of 2018 in one country look like the spy chief from 1650 in another country? So with all this in mind, we all of us put together a conference in Venice in May of 2014. We had over 40 or 50 participants, all talking about intelligence leaders from different countries around the globe. And then 4 years later, by hook or by crook, these two volumes materialize.
Yeah, so what, I mean, you've talked a couple things, but what really ties this book together was on face, you look at it and it looks almost like it's just a series of vignettes on intelligence leadership, because like you mentioned, from hundreds of years apart, from around the world, from countries that are as developed as the United States, UK and Russia, but also ones that are developing. So are there common themes? Are there things that bring this book together and make it more than just a bunch of chapters with an introduction and conclusion tacked on?
Yeah, I'd say I think the two volumes have slightly different emphases in that regard. So the first volume on US and UK, which I should say I was much more involved in than volume two, really is looking at these questions that Chris is talking about. And I suppose if you had to just sort of put it into one sentence, was really sort of trying to examine this notion that spy chiefs are secret and powerful. American and British spy chiefs are secret and powerful and operating behind the scenes to make things look not as they seem, right? Volume two certainly has aspects of that, a lot of aspects of that. But also it's looking at sort of the question of, are spy chiefs in democracies the same as spy chiefs in communist countries? And are those the same as spy chiefs in authoritarian, you know, like military dictatorships? Short answer being no. But those are, I think, how we would sort of characterize the two themes of these books. And we had great fun doing it. It's rough work going to a conference in Vienna and Venice rather to Vienna.
Right,
too,
you didn't put it in Hoboken. So can we, since you guys were the ones that put a lot of this together, you had to read everyone's, so you it's not like you just wrote your article and then never looked at anything else. You got the big kind of 30,000 foot view of this broader question. So are there identifiable qualities that make for a good intelligence leader from, you know, the foundation of this study?
I can't speak so much for volume two. So Dr. Paul Madrell is really the big thinker behind that one. But in terms of volume one, so making the comparisons between UK spy chiefs and US spy chiefs, I think one of the core themes of the volume is that the spy chief in 2018 in the 21st century has to be public, has to be visible, has to try and sell the intelligence mission to a skeptical Congress, to a skeptical Parliament, to an often to a public that is often inherently distrustful of intelligence activity. And the spy chief, I think we would wager our proposition, is plays a huge role now in trying to shape and influence those public misunderstandings in many cases about intelligence work. And they really have to perform this role. Because if an intelligence agency has a bad image, morale at that particular organization will be low, and then efficiency will suffer. But also appropriations committee, on who, you know, all organizations rely. You know, these are the people that write the checks. Appropriation committees will be a little bit nervous about signing those checks. Also, history teaches us that when intelligence agencies have a bad corporate image, you often get a lot of sort of vexing legal restrictions imposed on the agencies that can influence their day-to-day practice. So it's really important, therefore, in 2018 for spy chiefs to get out there and talk in very broad brushstrokes, only broad brushstrokes. I'm not talking granular detail that, you know, causes problems for sources and methods, but gives very broad brushstrokes about what intelligence agencies do.
Yeah, so I guess to just summarize that and then make an additional point, I mean, I think if I had to sum up what Chris was talking about, openness to the public is, you know, we asked this question in volume one, you know, how secret are US and UK spy chiefs really? And I think you could say the answer is they're less secret than they used to be, but they're probably still more secret than they should be for the strategic health of the intelligence services, which exist to serve these, you know, serve their nations. One of the other things that really comes out of this strongly too is a good intelligence leader is somebody who knows how to tend relationships in all directions, right? So it's really important, obviously, if you're an intelligence leader, an agency head, or whatever, to be able to work well and be responsive to your boss, to speak truth to power, but also sort of be useful to the boss in a non-politicized sort of way. So typically presidents and cabinet secretaries, that sort of thing. But also you have to be able to work with your peers, other agency heads and other, entities in the government, any number of DCI, directors of central intelligence here in the United States have had all sorts of difficulties because they couldn't necessarily get on with the Secretary of Defense, right, who has a much, 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 much bigger budget than they do, just by the way. And you need to be able to work with and develop positive relationships with the people below you. And it's a rare beast who can do all of these. But any one of those not dealt with properly, not tended to properly, the entire tenure of the leader could be, down the drain. I mean, they could fail in the broadest sense, on any of those points of the compass. Mm-hmm. And that's a rare person who can do that.
I'm interested to see if in 15, 20 years there's a volume 3 to this where it investigates the relationship of the DCIA with the DNI. And how, because that we haven't really had enough time or to really understand, and certainly we haven't had enough hardcore, full-fledged DNIs. Mm. You've got Clapper, and then everybody else was kind of
briefly.
And that relationship's interesting. I mean, you look at the Pompeo-Coates relationship, which was strained. That's my aside, but I let me go back to something that both of you talked about, especially you, Chris, talking about the idea of needing to be public and needing to understand this public thing. And I originally wanted to ask you, can this analysis of what makes a good leader be predictive? Can we look at someone who now happens to be nominated to be director of CIA, somebody who, when Gina Haspel's name was first brought up, if you Googled her, there wasn't a picture of her online, right? That is not someone who's ever lived publicly. She's had a very undercover clandestine life.
But there probably would be pictures of people in orange jumpsuits.
Sure. Right. So does that translate? I mean, is that, you said that is absolutely necessary in 2018 for someone to be public and be willing, not giving up sources and methods, but to be willing to have that public conversation. Is this something that you think is going to be problematic?
I'm a firm believer in a measured degree of openness for the purposes of ameliorating public understanding of intelligence issues. Let me just repeat here, I'm not proposing that spy chiefs bear the secrets of the company. I'm not proposing that they hawk secrets like they would or hawk them for profit. What I'm suggesting is targeted messages to prevent falsehoods and conspiracy theories hardening into fact. I'm proposing targeted messages to ensure that the appropriations keep rolling in. And actually, I think, the openness initiatives that countries on both sides of the Atlantic over the last 20 or 30 years have done. So in the United Kingdom, we've had official authorized histories of MI5 and MI6. We've seen a lot more public appearances by spy chiefs. One of the lessons from all of this is the world has not caved in. All of those concerns that the hardened Cold Warriors had in the 70s and 80s had about opening up a little bit was that, we give the public a little bit, their appetite will grow with the eating, and suddenly we'll be giving everything away. Right. Agents' names will be all over the front pages of The Guardian. Intelligence will just cease to be. Well, that hasn't happened. Those sort of truly cataclysmic predictions about, end of the world intelligence scenarios haven't happened. Measured degrees of openness, I think, are important.
I think also that we speculate in this book, and I actually think it may have been you, Chris, who's proposed this idea originally, though I'm not certain of this at this point. It's been a long time. But we propose the idea It's truly just a hypothesis, but that people who are leaders who are grown within the organization, as Gina Haspel has been, may have a little more difficulty when they reach the top job of having this degree of openness and this ability to deal with the public and the press in a more or less, we like to use the word translucent sort of way, because right up until then, they've been, had it beaten into them that you don't talk to the public, you don't talk to the press. In the U.S., you get polygraph exams every 5 years, a good hunk of which is about whether you know any reporters, right? Mm-hmm. In the United Kingdom, they don't typically do polygraphs, as I understand it, but you get to sign the truly draconian Official Secrets Act that basically says if you hint at anything ever, you're going to jail.
Yeah, off with your right?
And, this is beaten into you. And we have to imagine, though this is not something we've investigated systematically, but we have to imagine that that affects you, right? You can't just turn off, 30 years of instinct. When you become the CIA director or the NSA director or the head of MI6 or whatever.
This isn't just an academic hypothesis on our behalf. The notion that image matters and public education matters is actually something that even the most hardened secretive agencies get now. And probably the best illustration of this is GCHQ. Arguably the last great bastion of absolute secrecy. In 2014, right off the bat of the back of the Edward Snowden revelations, allegations of mass surveillance, all that sort of stuff, who did GCHQ appoint as its director? Did it appoint a 30-year intelligence veteran? No. It appointed instead Robert Hannigan, a PR guy, who has no experience of the intelligence business whatsoever. Robert Hannigan had been Tony Blair's director of communications in Northern Ireland. I think that was just that appointment was completely testament to the fact that intelligence agencies, even ones as secretive as GCHQ, now recognize that they operate in a brave new world where a measure of openness is an important part of their business.
Which is an amazing evolution, considering that the British government didn't even admit that GCHQ existed until 1994. I mean, obviously, anybody who had the slightest interest knew, but officially speaking, wasn't any such thing. Or, compared to William Casey at the CIA, so Reagan's first and very long-lasting CIA director, right, who wanted a not a low-profile agency, but a no-profile agency. Right, just can't get there from here these days, and you shouldn't try.
And we'll go along to congressional oversight hearings, with his marble mouth,
just right, sort of mumbling,
yes. Almost certainly to disguise, the statements he was looking to make.
Let me ask you a really wonky process question.
I do that when I can't answer questions.
Yeah, hopefully I can stump you on
this
one.
I'll pull out my Casey.
Let me ask you a really wonky process question. We've all done extensive research in intelligence archives. I wonder, look at the spy chiefs, even they don't know everything going on at their agency, right? There's certain things that don't reach to the level. There's a lot of moving parts that they can't be following on a day-to-day basis. So do you think the historical record's influenced by directors taking responsibility for what their agency does without their knowledge, essentially the whole the buck stops here philosophy, where we may not know what their real role was in some of these like covert operations or other things, because all the record tells us is what they've done kind of after the fact to say, yep, I'm in charge, I'm responsible, that's me.
Well, first of all, you wouldn't want an intelligence leader to know everything. That would not be practical. I think that there's a little bit of a misconception about what a leader in an intelligence context actually is and what it actually means. So an intelligence leader is not a manager. It's not a manager. In other words, he or she is not someone who should oversee every process and every procedure at every level. Nor is the spy chief the leader in an intelligence context a commander in a military sense. Save a few occasions, it is not their job to issue orders in moments in great urgent moments of crisis. I would put to you, and this is where my colleague Dr. Ioana Iordanou has got some good interventions. I would put to you that it's the job of the intelligence leader to ask the right questions. Their job is to ask the right questions that they then empower their followers to answer. But it is absolutely not in the spy chief's interest or the organization that they oversee for that person to know everything. Compartmentalization of knowledge is very important. If you have one person knowing everything, then they can actually be the one person that can give everything away.
Then is it fair to judge intelligence directors by what happens during their tenure?
Well, I mean, at some level you have to, otherwise you have no accountability whatsoever. On the other hand, what is, I don't quite know how to put this, but what is necessary from a public policy and accountability point of view that, yes, ultimately, you know, the buck has to stop with the agency chief who was responsible, quote unquote, that you, that should not be understood as meaning that realistically or, you know, let alone whether it's a good idea, realistically, agency heads are going to know, in fact, everything that's going on in their agency. Even, you know, the relatively small intelligence agencies are pretty darn large and have a lot of stuff going on. And when you get to, you know, the big ones, right, like NSA, for instance, mm-hmm. I mean, the really big daddy, you know, it's incredibly far flung, right? And in any large bureaucracy, you're going to have ill-advised things going on, you're going to have unauthorized things going on, and you're going to have things going on that look like a good idea at the time that the, you know, that the chief knew all about, but, you know, don't work out so well. So I think there's a difference between, as a practical matter, whether, you know, specific living human being really should be understood to be, you know, sort of morally responsible, and whether in a political or accountability kind of sense they should be held responsible. They're not necessarily, I think, the same thing. But agency chiefs, and I think you've got a story about some of the Watergate burglars, right?
Yeah.
Can inherit all sorts of, like, you know, I think you've called them landmines that, you know, they don't know are coming along. And, yeah. And suddenly now, like, I'm the director on the spot. I have to deal with this.
Yeah. So a lot of directors that come in from the outside, so they're political appointees, they haven't necessarily climbed the escarpments. They will join an agency and will quickly realize that there are landmines existing beneath their feet. So one that either did or could go off at any moment. So one, you know, fairly good example of this is CIA Director James Schlesinger. So he was appointed by Richard Nixon in early 73 with basically the objective to go and kick ass at the agency. Nixon's suspicion was that the agency was completely out of control and wasn't producing good assessments that he needed. Schlesinger soon discovers, as DCI, that two of the Watergate burglars had in their history worked for the CIA. He also discovers that those two Watergate burglars had received technical assistance from the agency in their running of dirty tricks operations for the Nixon White House. He learns these two priceless details not from his underlings and subordinates at the CIA, but from the front pages of the Washington Right. Post and the New York Times. Suddenly, PR storm breaks out, and who takes the blame for that? James Schlesinger. And of course, that little story is what triggered him to send that directive. It was actually penned by William Colby, but it was ordered by Schlesinger, who the Family Jewels mm-hmm. directive. He was the one who said, I want to know what other landmines exist beneath my feet. A few weeks later, 700 pages of alleged infractions and violations are put on his desk. And then when that's leaked in December 1974, I think, by Cy Hirsch in the New York Times, suddenly a landmine goes off for his successor, William Colby.
And you should also not necessarily assume that all of the subordinates in an agency necessarily desire to share everything they're doing with the chief, because, you know, that implies giving the chief some degree of control that they may not wish to give up. So my chapter on John Grombach gets into this to some degree, but a better example, because it's bigger and fundamentally, ultimately more important, is at the National Security Agency, where for decades, right, it's a very large agency, does highly technical stuff, has frequently been headed by NSA directors who did not have a background in signals intelligence, right, who are very smart men. So far, they've all been men, very smart men, all of them. But gosh, you know, you can get lost in understanding SIGINT really quickly, right? But NSA for decades was sort of divided up into these sort of technical fiefdoms, right? Presided over by senior executives, sort of second tier executives in NSA who were called the warlords, who had precisely zero desire to give, you know, any director of NSA any significant control over what I'm doing in my. So you just.
Right, because these are the technocrats, right? These are the people that actually understood the technology.
Turf conscious technocrats. Right. So you just go over there on the executive suite, Mr. Director, and you just don't worry your pretty little head about what I'm doing here, please. Thank you very much. Right? And one could readily imagine that whether it's, you know, malfeasance, or just things not going well, that there could be all kinds of things hidden down below there that an NSA director might or might not ever know about, but will and should ultimately be held responsible for if something happens.
It wouldn't necessarily So one of the lessons from the Schlesinger period, it's not necessarily in the best interests of a newly appointed spy chief to go in and immediately say, I want to know all the bad stuff that's going on in this organization. You don't necessarily want to start on that foot. You know, immediately you've put noses out of joint. Immediately you've got a bloody nose. Immediately your workforce don't trust you. So that's a real delicate one, actually, for any incoming director of the CIA, any incoming director of NSA. You want to know where the skeleton, you want to know where the bodies are buried, but you need to know in a way that...
In due course.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I mean, that certainly, if you're coming in from the outside, that's a different perspective than if you buried some of the bodies yourself.
Yes,
certainly.
I'm not casting aspersions on anyone in particular. Literally, I'm not trying to. But that's an interesting. I mean, do you guys look at that at all? I mean, you've mentioned it a couple times now of the people brought in from the outside versus those that have worked their way up. Have you noticed? Maybe it's not in the book, but have you noticed any differences between the homegrowns, right? You know, think of John Brennan, who worked his way, or an analyst versus an operations person. I'm writing volume 3 for you right now, right? You know, people.
Because we're going to make so much money on volumes right. 1 and 2 that there's going to be an undeniable demand for volume 3.
Georgetown University Press is going to be like, where is volume 3? I mean, have you noticed any differences there? I mean, we now have kind of the Brennan tenure ended, you know, a year and a half ago or so, and he was really the last American CIA director that came kind of from the system itself, and then bring in Pompeo, who was an outsider to intelligence almost completely.
Well, we haven't looked at that in a systematic sort of way, but I do in all seriousness agree that that would be something I think interesting and useful to look at, and may well do that. But I would say that as important as that factor probably is, there's so many others that can either facilitate success or lead to failure that it might be hard to tease that out, right? I mean, so an agency head who maybe you know comes from the outside, but has a very good working relationship with you know the president, for instance, is probably in a better position than an agency head who sort of bubbles, you know, comes up through the ranks and sort of knows the precise levers within an agency, but you know, maybe doesn't have a relationship with the president. So there's a lot of things in play. There's a lot of moving parts here.
I might have a be able to flush that one out. I think if you look at the two volumes as a whole, and some of the spy chiefs who have been outsiders and who've come in, I think my proposition would be they often have a very good vision. They often have a very good vision for what an intelligence agency should be doing and what it should look like, but they have a bad strategy for implementing that vision. So one obvious example that springs to mind is Admiral Stansfield Turner. So he's brought in as Jimmy Carter's DCI in 77. I think, I mean, I'm going to sound like a Turner apologist here, but what the hell. I think he has a pretty good vision for what the CIA should look like in the modern era. He wants to do some house cleaning. He wants to clear out some of the cowboys, the Good Shepherd generation of intelligence officers, the swashbucklers that have got the agency into trouble. He wants to install more analysts, more thinkers at the CIA. He also wants to give more headway to young officers who want to be promoted, whose path to promotion has been historically blocked by aging senior officers. And he also wants to see a little bit more technical collection being done because he genuinely has a heartfelt desire not to put assets and agents in harm's way. Intelligence is a very difficult business. So the vision is great, I think, in Turner's case, but the strategy for implementing that was absolutely terrible. He arrived at the CIA, brought with him his real kind of military personality, forces background to what is fundamentally a civilian organization, immediately started putting noses out of joint, insisted on being called admiral, would always talk about, you know, things being ship shape, and fired just under 2 years, fired 800 staff. And he did this in the most cold-blooded manner possible. It was just sort of two-sentence pink slips being issued to staff saying, clear your desk out by 5 p.m., thank you very much, you're on your way. You know, a ghastly slur for people who served their country with devotion in most cases for decades. And he bled needlessly for that. You know, he suffered unbelievable amounts of resistance from disgruntled intelligence officers. You know, they leaked in their droves. They, some even considered taking a lawsuit out against Turner. Imagine that, CIA officers thinking about taking a lawsuit out against their boss. So Turner's a great case, you know, of great vision, bad strategy. And the bad strategy was in part, I think, because as an outsider, he didn't get the culture. And, you know, we'll throw it out there. One of the other themes is, you know, a lot of outsiders come in and they want to change the culture of an intelligence agency, which isn't necessarily a bad thing. But before they do that, they have to at least be seen to respect that culture and acknowledge that, you know, in the past, hitherto, that culture has worked.
Hey, everybody. Today, I want to highlight a name that all of us know well, and that is our sponsor, Splunk. You need to keep operations humming around the clock, but potential disruptions are everywhere. Splunk helps you predict problems and find and fix issues fast so you can reduce risk and ditch downtime. The world's largest enterprises rely on Splunk's unified security and observability platform to become more efficient, resilient, and innovative. With Splunk, you can react quickly, evolve faster, and be ready for anything. Stay ahead of disruptions. Learn more at splunk.com/resilience. And we thank Splunk for sponsoring our show. The IT world used to be simpler. You only had to secure and manage environments that you controlled. Then came new technologies and new ways to work. Now, employees, apps, and networks are everywhere. This means poor visibility, security gaps, and added risk. That's why Cloudflare created the first-ever connectivity cloud. Visit cloudflare.com to protect your business everywhere you do business.
So, Mark, your previous answer actually focused on the CIA director's importance kind of looking up, right, at his or her bosses. Right. And that was kind of the key component of a successful CIA director is someone that can work with the president and work with Congress. Chris, you just kind of focus on looking down, like understanding how the culture of CIA matters and being able to work with people. So I would argue that you're arguing with each other, that there is a disconnect here. And so let me force you to kind of reconcile this a little bit. Maybe the answer is both matter. But
yes.
Yes, we agree. We agree. We're not putting weight on either.
But I mean, so clearly Turner was handpicked basically by Jimmy Carter, had a great relationship from the Navy days, right? They were, I think, classmates.
That's it. Yep.
Right. So there obviously was a great working up relationship, but a horrendous working down relationship. And then someone perhaps who doesn't get along all that well with the president. Well, Dick Helms is a great example, right? He's a CIA lifer, right? They love him there.
Well beloved, yes.
But both were seen as somewhat failures. So is there disconnect here?
No, I don't think there's a disconnect. I think what you've hit on is that being an intelligence chief, being a spy chief, is an extraordinarily difficult job, and the roads to failure are many, and the roads to success are few. Is the way I would look at that, which I guess gets back also in a way to one of our other sort of initial questions is, you know, how powerful are these folks really? And the answer is, well, obviously they're not trivial, but at the end of the day, the thing that really struck us. Is all of just the problems and the constraints and the friction and the pushback and the how darn difficult all these jobs are, right? Because you've got all sorts of rivals and it's just a pain in the neck, and it's all embedded within a democratic system where, you know, you're supposed to be held to account, right? You know, these people are powerful, but these are difficult jobs, and there are many, many, many ways to fail because you screw up any of these important relationships, and you are likely to be seen, and rightly so, as more of a failure than a success. And you screw up with two of them, and you're doomed, and it's very easy to screw them all up.
Right. and you know, different constituencies define success in very different terms. So the commander in chief might define what qualifies as a successful spy chief in a very different way to how the rank and file at the agency. I mean, Trump would be a great example. So when he issued his travel ban last year from predominantly, I think it was 7 or 8 Muslim countries in the Middle East, my understanding is that the executive order, the travel ban, went out of the door before he actually had the intelligence in his hand to confirm whether there was a genuine security risk at play here. So he says to the head of the CIA at the time, look, my order's gone out the door. Now find me the intelligence.
Right.
Now find me the intelligence to prove me that I was right. So if the CIA director then finds that intelligence for the president, in Trump's eyes, that CIA director is a success. But the CIA director's underlings at CIA might look at that and say, well, that's not a success at all. You've just completely corrupted the intelligence process.
Well, I think of find me the WMDs is...
Yeah, similar sort of deal. Yeah. And I think there's a... And I know here we're mostly talking about the U.S. and the U.K., but just briefly to think about some non-democratic states that are so important, much of the focus of Volume 2. The looking east and west, looking at your peers and looking at your subordinates is much less important to spy chiefs in non-democratic states, in military dictatorships or in communist countries. I mean, in those things, far and away, I mean, this is all still important, but far and away, the relationship that matters is your relationship to the Communist Party leadership or your relationship to the particular general who happens to be in the presidential palace. And everything else is of secondary importance. Whereas, thank God, in democratic states like ours, all sorts of other constituents, including congresses and parliaments that represent the people, and including the press, who in a different sort of way represent the people, are important constituencies that need to be dealt with in a more or less open sort of way, as open as possible.
In African countries, actually being a very successful spy chief is quite literally damaging to your health, because suddenly you perform so well in your job and you become a threat. Right. To the dictatorial political leadership of these countries. And there's been, quite very, very bloody and very, very public dismissals of, very good, very well-functioning spy chiefs in certain African countries over the last 50 or 60 years.
We think of Beria and the Soviet Union, who...
Oh, yeah.
The only reason he stayed alive was the atomic bomb and his ability to pull information from that. I also think I thought of another constituency that might be important, especially for the U.S.-U.K. relationship. And that word was relationship. I mean, the ability to get along with the other Five Eyes members, the ability to get along with NATO and with the other spy chiefs now, especially in 2018, seems to be a key consideration of someone who's successful. And in particular, this is problematic. And I think the forward, maybe it was what Pat Hughes was talking about in the forward to the book, is the idea that in some cases, these might be people you operated against back in the day, because enemies then become allies now, and kind of the ability to have that cooperation is so important nowadays to successful intelligence agencies.
No, I think that's absolutely right. For both the United States and for the United Kingdom, having, liaison partners, the intelligence services of other countries is tremendously important. And it's not, I mean, we all know this, but I think in the public realm, it's maybe not as well understood as it should be, because those are among the things that are, never declassified, right?
Right.
Because if two or more countries need to sign off on the declassification. So that I don't think is nearly as well understood. But yeah, tending those relationships is absolutely important as well. And there's a wonderful chapter in the book written by Chris's colleague, Richard Aldrich of Warwick, on NSA Director Bill Odom. Actually, he'd been head of Army Intelligence and then became head of NSA. And while he was at NSA, he was kind of a bull in a china shop, kind of a bully. Richard's wonderful chapter title is they calls him the intellectual redneck. But one of his sort of most important characteristics was that he was really awful in a lot of ways at tending some of the most important liaison relationships. He flat out considered the head of GCHQ at the time, he just had no respect for the guy. And that extraordinarily important, this is in the 80s, right? This is a big deal. That extraordinarily important relationship suffered. He thought that France was going to be a comparably important partner to NSA, and worked really hard to make that happen, and that never really came to fruition. Right? You know, maybe in the current era things are different, but back in the 80s, that was this bad strategic choice. And he got, you know, made himself buddy-buddy with, thought his new best friend was going to be the incoming head of the German BND, the Bundesnachrichtendienst, which is not only Germany's CIA, but also Germany's NSA. And the guy got himself, you know, fired after a month on a, you know, security scandal, and sort of left that relationship sort of hanging right in midair. Mm-hmm. Those sort of screw-ups in dealing with important foreign partners are among the things, I mean, it's a fairly long list in Odom's case, but among the things that lead him to be widely considered a failed NSA director.
The spy chiefs within the Five Eyes community, they'll often play a key role in smoothing relations over, smoothing relations between these countries at the intelligence level after, you know, bad calls by their political leadership. So one example, you mentioned Richard Aldrich here a moment ago, and I think his research on the Kissinger cutoff, I should say, is highly appropriate here. So we're 74, 75. Kissinger, U.S. Secretary of State, is getting really annoyed with the British Prime Minister because in his eyes, the British Prime Minister is cozying up a little bit too close to Brussels. Is cozying up a little bit too close to the newly formed European Economic Community, and he sat there thinking, "Hey, you know what's going on here? You know, it's London and Washington, right? We need the special relationship. You know, stop getting in bed with the Europeans." So Kissinger, in a political move to teach the Brits a lesson, says to the head of the NSA, "Turn the tap off. Turn the tap off. We're going to teach these Brits a lesson. We're going to stop it. We're going to stop sharing intelligence with them." So suddenly the tap is turned off, and the head of GCHQ rings up. I think is it Peter Mary Church? I forget now. The head of GCHQ rings up his counterpart at NSA and says, "What's going on here? Suddenly the world has gone dark." And actually, then it is incumbent upon the NSA chief not only to try and reconvince, you know, Kissinger that he's made a bad political call, but suddenly it's his job to smooth things over with the British and doubtless the other three or four members of the Five Eyes communities.
I wonder how important it is to understand what makes some of these guys tick, is to understand their influences from other countries. I mean, you can't write a decent biography of Bill Donovan without thinking about Bill Stevenson, right? You know, it's Wild Bill and Little Bill, because you don't get the OSS without the British bringing over their expertise from abroad. You know, you look at, I can imagine if you're a brand new CIA director and your first phone call with a longstanding MI6 director, let's say, you know, somebody who's been in the job for a couple of years, that's your only peer, right? Or maybe, you know, the head of DGSC or the head of the BND. Those are the only people who have done what you've done or you're going to be doing. They, to me, would be who I would ring up and be like, you know, kind of walk me through this a little bit. How much do we see that? I mean, the famous one is Bill and Bill, but right, are there other instances where that pops up?
I don't know about specific instances, but I think your general intuition is correct. But I'd hypothesize, and I don't know, Chris may have more tangible thoughts here, but I'd hypothesize that varies from agency to agency. Right. So somebody in NSA or GCHQ, at least if they're ascended up through the ranks or have a background in SIGINT, are likely to have had, you know, recurring and probably quite cordial and cooperative relations with their partners in, you know, across the pond. And probably to some degree, CIA and Britain's SIS, or as I always call it, MI6, even though it's officially not its name, because they're both friendly and global espionage services. But I don't know if that's necessarily so true with, say, you know, somebody rising to the head of Army Intelligence or the head of NGA or something, where those liaison relationships are either not as broad or maybe where it's, you know, regional, right? But I'm speculating here. It's frankly not something I'd thought about before.
I think your proposition is absolutely sound, and I think Volume 3 of the Spy Chiefs.
Volume 3 is getting bigger and bigger.
Yeah.
The subtitle is going to be like, what Vince would do if he was CIA director.
But I think what I would say is I would draw your listeners' attention to Paul Madrell's chapter in Volume 2, where in addition to looking at a particular East German spy chief, offers some interesting assessments of spy chiefs across the Iron Curtain. And that's fascinating reading. You know, you've got spy chiefs in different Soviet satellite states, on the one hand having to do their own thing, but at the same time, pleased that the leadership from Moscow. That's
right.
Tough.
The East German Soviet example is a great one of these people like Marcus Wolf and Eric Milka, who are now revered and or reviled as having this massive amount of power, certainly over their society, but they were always looking to Moscow, you know, for guidance.
Yeah, well, and it's an interesting point, too, now that you put that out about the Warsaw Pact. I mean, I can imagine, so the Norwegian intelligence service, 15, 20 years ago almost now, did one of these authorized histories, right, where they gave a historian access to the classified archives. And one of the things we learned was through much of the history of the Norwegian intelligence service, some enormous percentage of that service's budget, I want to say something like 80 or 90% actually came from the United States. Because really, the Norwegian intelligence service was joined at the hip with NSA, and I would have to imagine—I'm speculating here—but I would have to imagine that if you rise to the, at least in that time, if you rose to be the head of the Norwegian intelligence service, you'd probably spend a whole lot of time hanging out with American counterparts, and you probably weren't going to get that job unless you were on good terms with your American colleagues, and you'd probably learned a lot from them, and they from you too. But they had probably, the Americans had probably very much influenced your worldview. But we do not have a chapter on Norway. Another thing for volume three. Already, so we'll put you down for the even numbered chapters.
You're welcome. I've written your volume three to have this conversation. But let me ask you this question, because both of you deal with an area, World War II period plus the early Cold War in your particular chapter of this book. And Chris, you have a lot of kind of your past, your research study, your background deals with pop culture and the influence of pop culture. And so you've got the sexy period of World War II and the early Cold War, and you yourself, your interest is pop culture. So I'm interested in, did you have that in mind when you were putting this book together, of the pop cultural perception of these chiefs? Now, that's my part A of my question.
Sure.
And then part B is, how much were these chiefs themselves influenced by pop culture? Not just the books they read that were nonfiction, but, you know, Dick Helms was 1960s and 70s. So you've got Bond, you've got Le Carré books, you've got all this stuff going back to the 30s and 40s. And, you know, whether it's the 1950s and that time period, there's still some kind of spy pop culture, or at least the public perception of the G-men from the Hoover period and everything else. So can you talk a little bit about that multifaceted question?
I think this is... James Derderian is the scholar, political scientist, who works most in this area, and he talks about the... So we're going to get very theoretical, probably the only time I'm going to get theoretical in my academic career, but he talks about the co-constituted nature of fiction and reality. He talks about the way that spy fact and spy fiction are mutually constituted. Now, what he means by that, and this is still to be flushed out and properly explored, what he means by that is that spy fiction influences spy fact, but also spy fact influences spy fiction. So I think a lot of research has been done on how spy fact influences spy fiction. What that area of research is basically, you know, to what extent do spy fiction authors draw on what's going on in the real world of espionage? And in the case of those spy authors who've been in the business, like Le Carré and Fleming, you know, you can see that being the case. But the other question of how spy fiction has influenced spy fact is a really, really new and fertile area of possible inquiry. I mean, we know from your wonderful exhibition here in D.C., Exquisitely Evil on James Bond, we know that CIA director Alan Dulles was absolutely fascinated and looked to draw inspiration from Q Branch. He thought, Fleming, your Q Branch is wonderful. These poison-tipped dagger shoes, these homing beacons that we can put in an Aston Martin DB5, I think they're great, and I'm going to ask my CIA engineers to see if they can replicate this type of technology. You mentioned Helms and fiction. He's fascinated. So you would think that Helms would hate James Bond and love John le Carré. Actually, it was the opposite. So I say you would think Helms thought that. Sorry, the beeping has confused me. Yeah. Because you would think, okay, Helms is the intelligence professional personified. What on earth is he going to like about, you know, cars flying off cliffs and, you know, cars going under the ocean and, you know, villains with dentures made out of steel? What on earth is Dick Helms going to like about this? But actually, Helms liked Bond because it was nevertheless a representation of the intelligence business that he liked and he recognized. You know, Bond, it's an agent saving the world, doing a job with high risk and little reward. There's a clear line between the good guys and the bad guys in Bond. Whereas Le Carre, you would think, Helms would surely like Le Carre. You know, it's more realistic, it's more gritty. But actually, he hated Le Carre because in Le Carre, philosophically, it was just a representation of the intelligence business that Helms hated, because ideologically in Le Carre, the East and the West, the KGB and MI5 are the same, the different sides of the same grubby coin.
It's much grayer.
Exactly.
Yeah, and pop culture, actually, I mean, the very first paragraph in the introduction of Volume 1 is about pop culture, right? It's keying off of a scene in The Hunt for Red October, which we use to frame this notion that spy chiefs are, you know, constantly operating in the shadows and manipulating stuff, and none of us really realize it, right?
It wasn't Russians don't take a dump without a plan, son?
No, it was James Earl Jones and I was never here. Now I forget where I was going with it. So one of the things also that I think is so interesting, so we've talked a good bit here about intelligence chiefs, spy chiefs having to be accountable to the public and being held to account for bad things that are done on their watch and all that sort of stuff. And I find it fascinating that at the same time that the spy fiction that's so popular is typically the sort of stuff that, you know, most people in the voting public would be appalled if their intelligence agencies were actually doing. I mean, go look at James Bond, right? We see all this uproar, not unreasonably. I'm not staking out a position here in any way, but not unreasonably about, you know, maltreatment of detainees and all this sort of thing. Well, Bond never takes detainees. He just shoots people in the head, right? He can't keep his pants zipped. He's buying champagne on the government dime, right? You know, this is fraud, waste, and abuse, and war crimes, and God only knows what. In concentrated form, right? And the public loves it, but they don't really want that, right? So I think that's an interesting phenomenon.
So let me wrap up this conversation by asking you about sources, because you don't. We may not need a volume 3, although we've already written it, because the influx of memoirs recently has been extraordinary. And I kind of, this point was drawn out a little bit by your chapter, Chris, looking at Helms kind of almost starting that trend with CIA help of writing the unofficial official history of his time there. But basically, you know, not only every Navy SEAL who went through BUDS has a book contract, but it seems like anyone who is a deputy director or above at any major intelligence agency is writing a tell-all book about their time as a spy chief. Do we know too much, or are these even useful? I mean, are they so whitewashed and so CYA from my perspective that they don't provide any real evidence for us to understand kind of what really made them tick?
I think that for me, the main disappointment about the intelligence memoir genre is the two-tier system that's in place. So there seems to be a system where directors, deputy directors, and kind of really high-profile operations people can write books with near impunity. They can operate as if they're effectively above the law. They can say what they want. In a number of cases, they'll actually receive a lot of sort of, you know, private back-channel assistance from the agency, and, you know, the agency's in question in terms of putting the books together. There'll be some ghostwriting and such forth.
Was it Panetta who just said, screw it?
Yeah.
Going through the PR, thought it was taking too long and just published it anyway, and they're going to retroactively.
That's
anyway,
right.
Yeah.
Can you imagine what would happen to somebody like me?
That's
where I was going. And yet the rank and file are not given anywhere near as much freedom and latitude to even write the mildest, the littlest of things and indiscretions, to the extent where actually a lot of the rank and file memoirs, just to go back to your earlier point, resemble more spy fiction than spy fact, because in their cases, that things like the Publications Review Board will get the authors to fictionalize so much of the narrative, the changing of names, the changing of locations, the changing of almost everything,
right.
that actually these books read like works of fiction rather than memoirs.
So, well, a couple of thoughts on this. So first off, I mean, memoirs are definitely important sources for historians, but you have to, you know, sort of realize that, you know, every memoir writer is the hero of his or her own book and is sort of casting things that way, right? So, but as long as you take those sorts of issues into account and issues of memory and all that, they're very useful, when, particularly when you can triangulate with other historical sources. But I actually want to quibble a little bit with the premise of your question, that I'm not sure that memoir writing for spy chiefs is so widespread at all. I think, and I'm open to counter arguments on this, but I see it actually very concentrated in a very narrow place. So it has become extremely common for CIA directors to write memoirs. More of them do than don't, right? sometimes after some delay, like Richard Helms, but more of them do than don't. Ditto FBI directors. There has been one NSA director who's written a memoir, Hayden, who, by the way, was also a CIA director.
Right.
Most American intelligence chiefs don't write memoirs. It's extremely rare. It's not unheard of. Roger Hilsman, who headed state INR back in the early 60s, wrote a memoir. Okay, fine. But you have to look long and hard. And you go over to Britain. No head of GCHQ has written a memoir. No head of MI6 has written a memoir. There have been two memoirs from the heads of MI5. One of them, Sir Percy Sillitoe, wrote his memoir back in the 1950s. And the book said essentially nothing about MI5 at all because they were pretending MI5 didn't exist at the time, so the censors wouldn't let him say anything. And the other one was Dame Stella Remington. You know, and MI5's been around for a century, well, more than a century now, right? So I think it's in the U.S., not in the U.K., and I think it's in a very small number of agencies in the U.S., not broadly in the U.S. So personally, I don't look out there and get the impression, gosh, there's so many spy chief memoirs. I'm thinking, like, why aren't there more?
So the book itself is Spy Chiefs. It's two volumes set. Volume one deals specifically with the United States and the United Kingdom, and then volume two goes all over the world and chronologically is very varied from Renaissance Venice to modern day lots of places. So thank you so much, Mark Stout, Chris Moran, for taking the time to talk to us here on SpyCast. We truly appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Thanks, Vince. Thank you.